Hello and welcome to this double bill episode featuring the announcement of what our wonderful patrons have voted for our next production next year. And then after that, there will be a regular podcast with a Lost discussing episode recorded just before the plague. More on that anon. So, we had a number of really great plays suggested by our patrons, whose votes continue to stack up. Now, due to the plague, we have something of a backlog, and we've been having to change how we record some of our plays as we go forward. We also have a lot of plays that have been suggested that haven't quite hit the numbers of votes, so we've got a lot of plays in the running that all have about the same number of votes, and which some sort of decision had to be made. And because we've got such a backlog and we only have so much money coming in at the moment, of course, if you want to become a patron now or donate to us on Ko-fi.com or similar, then that gives us more room for manoeuvre and potentially more plays to do in the next year. But at the moment, I'm only promising one new patron choice for the coming season because there's still so much to clear. So we've had new votes this season for Cleopatra by Samuel Daniel, John Baptist's Preaching by John Bale, Lady Lumley's translation of the Tragedy of Iphigenia, and Arden of Faversham by The Unknown, and Two Angry Women of Abington by Henry Porter, Damon and Pythias by The Unknown, and Callisto and Melibea from the press of John Rastall, and a few more texts that didn't quite make the top rank. Out of those plays, a couple stood out in terms of votes, and so it ended up being a choice between The Tragedy of Iphigenia and Arden of Faversham. And the winner was, drumroll please, I would do a drumroll but I don't have a drum, Lady Lumley and her translation of Iphigenia. But, as a consolation prize, we will be workshopping Arden of Faversham over the next year and putting it in the long-term planning roster along with A Game at Chess, Thomas of Woodstock, Dido, Queen of Carthage, and the other popular votes we've had so far. All of those, you will note, are big productions, apart from possibly Dido, and therefore we are playing a long game on those. The Tragedy of Iphigenia will complete our first phase of work on the women writing in the pre-Jacobean period. We have essentially a trilogy of three tragedies with the upcoming releases of the tragedies of Mariam and Antony. There are still more female-led texts to come. Not that many. I use the word female-led to expand our frame of reference as we go into the Jacobean. But these three plays cover this first phase very nicely, taking us up to 1602-ish, I think, with Mariam. I think that's where it generally is dated. As we go beyond that, and I do want to continue championing the women who were writing and performing in the early modern period. As we go forward, we're going to be including a lot more masks. We've got at least one more full-length play, and there's some other fragments and pieces to do. There isn't that much before we hit the interregnum, which is technically our endpoint, but we're going to try and get everything done that we can. The plan is to record Iphigenia in the spring of 2023, so next spring, and that will then end with a live stream performance of the audio feed for our patrons and a paying ticketed audience for those who are not patrons. And hopefully that will bring in a bit more money to move into the next productions that we go after that. I've provisionally put John Baptist's Preaching by John Bale into the stretch goal area should we gain more patrons or support over the next few months. And if that happens, we'd probably do the whole Baal trilogy of biblical plays at the same time, because they're all quite small cast and quite short and very much within the area of infilling in our timelines. We're very interested in doing as much of the Henrician drama, the drama of Henry VIII, trying to do a lot of that, because we've already done the John Hayward and other bits and pieces from that period. So it's I like the idea of being able to pull all those pieces together. And additional commissions and activity will be produced as and when money or opportunities arise, because sometimes someone comes to us with a proposal and we go, oh yes, we can do that, and then we do it and more stuff happens. And that's sort of where we're hoping to go over the next few months. But as and when money and or opportunities arise, more things will be announced. But for the moment, we can, as I say, confirm that we're definitely doing the tragedy of Iphigenia, as translated by Lady Lumley, and we're going to be working in detail over many months on the text of Arden of Faversham, as well as the source. We've already done some work on that already, and there will be more on that coming anon. But that ends the first part of this episode. Now to the main body of the podcast. And this is a lost discussing episode. It is either the first or second of these I've released. I've actually forgotten off the top of my head whether I've released any of these yet. I definitely have to the patrons, but I haven't necessarily released these to the real world. So this is a lost discussing episode. We have recorded lots of interviews with lots of people. This is the second. I've just remembered. This is the second one that we are releasing to the real world on the podcast, which means one of my links is wrong in a later one. Anyway, we recorded lots of interviews. Some of them were delayed just simply because there was technical problems with the recording. Some of them because we were trying to connect it up with other stuff we were doing at the time. This one has been delayed because it was just a bit sad, and it still is a bit sad, because this was an interview with Beth Burns of Hidden Room Theatre, and we were discussing a production of Arden of Faversham, connected with the first part of this podcast, which was going to be coming to London to be performed, and there was a lot of discussion of future projects happening with Hidden Room Theatre. Sadly, this was recorded just before the plague started, so this production didn't transfer and didn't carry on from where it was at the precise time of recording, pretty much. So this frequently refers to future plans that sadly do not happen. And it is a sad thing to have an interview so filled with hope and promise. And it was a lovely interview, and I really enjoyed doing it and chatting with Beth Burns. And it shows how much has changed in the world of theatre in the last few years. But sadness aside, it is a good introduction to the play of Arden of Faversham and a few others, and gives a really good idea of how it functions in performance. And of course, there is always room for hope that such things may start up again. So, with all those caveats aside, off to visit past Robert in the heady days of 2020, and my guest Beth Burns, recorded via the futuristic technology of Skype. Yeesh.
I am Beth Burns. I'm the artistic director of the Hidden Room Theater, currently in Austin, Texas.
So, if we could start with, tell me a bit about the history of Hidden Room Theater and your setup, because it looks very, very interesting from the interweb, from this distance distance away. tell me about the setup and what you do.
Sure. So Hidden Room was founded by me about 10 years ago. We'll be coming up on our 10th anniversary here in late April. When I first moved to Austin, I think the one thing that I felt like we were really missing was scholarship-based theater. And that was what I happened to be interested in at the time. And so I founded Hidden Room with the hopes of mixing my interest for scholarship and page to stage type work, and also my experience coming from the Groundlings Theater. Prior to that, I'd been in Los Angeles working for the Groundlings, which is a well-known comedy, a sketch comedy and improv group. And I had been a teacher and a performer at the Groundlings for about 10 years prior. And I found that that early modern theater and improv of that nature actually mixed really nicely together. Mm. And so I was able to sort of take those two passions, bring them together and make Hidden Room. And I also had a third interest, which was immersive, interactive theater, and technologically forward-thinking theater. So we still do a little bit of that as well. We primarily work out of a Masonic lodge here in Austin called the York Rite Masonic Lodge. The Masons have been very kind to us to let us use that quite a bit. And that's been our home. And it's a really great, mysterious kind of place with all sorts of corridors, darkened corridors to go through. And I thought, what a great vibe for a theater, you know, call it the Hidden Room, and we'll be able to, you know, have a password when people come in and, you know, traverse this incredibly mysterious building. And eventually you kind of find at the end of your journey throughout the building, you find this beautiful lodge room. It's sort of grand and it has seating on either side. And the nice thing is that sort of also replicates an early modern court setting, like a lot of shows in the late 1500s, early 1600s would have been performed when being performed for royalty and whatnot. Mm. So so that's what we do. I like to say we make time machines. We started focusing a lot on recreating practices, playing practices that have either been forgotten or dismissed because they're not in fashion anymore, things like theatrical gesture, or older ways of building characters. And that's been really interesting to me for a long time. You know, a deeper sense of original practices, to really dig in and see, you know, have we thrown away any useful tools just because it wasn't cool for a while? You know, if you dig in your grandma's closet and you come across a really ace sweater that she thought was gross 10 years after she bought it, but you get far enough away from it and you go, oh, this sweater is fantastic. Why are we not wearing it right now? So that's what I do.
It really interests me because my obviously what we do is technologically driven as well as live shows. And my background is in storytelling and clown and to some degree improvisation as well. And I find that synthesis and connection with early modern drama is the direction. I was talking to one of my actors today and they were sort of saying, oh, sometimes we're not bit worried about not being classically trained, and I'm going, I'm not classically trained. I have no classical training at all, beyond, you know, little bits and bobs that one picks up as an actor. It's all about how you interact with these texts and make them dynamic, and how texts have room for games and other things that are not in the words. And we've really found that with some of the plays we've done. Even though we've been working with them primarily as audio, constantly looking for what's physically going on, and plays like Gamma Gurton's Needle, which we did recently, it's full of physical comedy games. It's just full of them.
And can I piggyback on that and say also, you know, a big thing that we do at Groundlings is we build character. We do something called making a mountain out of a molehill, right? Mm. Turning a small clue and making that into a big choice, a big emotional choice, a big physical choice, a big character choice. And a lot of that can also be found in early modern text by the sounds of the words. Mm. So all of a sudden, does the dialogue become clipped? You know, is this character starting to use a lot of D's and T's? Do they have a feminine ending there? Or, you know, do the words soften out? What is the small clue that I can take from this text and make it into a really strong choice? And that was another place where I felt like improv really was quite helpful in terms of building and using early modern theater in a way that really makes it come alive in an exciting way. And on top of that, you know, if you have that same kind of attention that you have when you're improvising, where you're really focused quite strongly on your scene partners and you're right there and you're never quite sure what they're going to be doing next and you're really yes-anding everything that they give you, It really makes for a much more enjoyable experience. So I make sure that all my actors, even when they're doing scripted work, that they have a certain amount of freedom. We don't, we block out basically what we're going to do, but within that, we really give everybody a lot of freedom so that based on whatever choice their partner happens to make that day, that you're really responding to what you get and that you're not just sort of giving off the laundry list. You're not only fresh minting your lines because that's what the character would do as the character's thinking about it, but you, the actor, is really alive and present on stage. And I think without that kind of improv training, actors can feel really, really vulnerable in a situation. But with improv training, it's really invigorating and freeing.
You mentioned gesture acting, and I saw it on the website. And before we get to talking about plays and shows and things that you're doing, could you talk a little bit more about that? Because it's something I've sort of noticed in passing, but I've not done any work on. Could you tell us what you've been doing or are doing with that?
Absolutely. So one of the things, as I said, that I'm most interested in is looking for forgotten playing practices. And gesture work had kept coming back in front of, it kept coming to my desk, right? I'm looking for, one thing or another, and I'm seeing a painting or an engraving, and there's the actor involved in gesture. Or I'm looking into Hal Betterton created characters, and he's talking about gesture. And I thought, if you think about how people, if somebody's going to make fun of theater, the first thing they do is they take the back of their hand and they put it up on their forehead and they tip their head back. And this is, and they go, oh, it was like this, right? And isn't it laughable? But that's just gesture acting, right? That's an actual codified gesture that means despair. And so I thought, well, gosh, if people were doing it for so long, if it didn't, it only fell out of favor, in the, say, the early 1900s. If people were doing it all the way through then, from the beginnings that we know of theater, it must have been effective. People must have liked it. Like, why would we toss it away so completely? So I started looking into it, and I started realizing that theatrical gesture changes a lot, right? So the way that I did it, with my team, and I'm incredibly lucky because I work with some of the smartest scholars in the world, and I started this work specifically with Farah Karim over at Shakespeare's Globe, and Tiffany Stern, who's currently over at the Shakespeare Institute, two of the smartest just hero scholars that I can think of, and started using their research, and we started, Hidden Room acts as a laboratory for their research. And we start with what we absolutely know, right? What is the kind of theatrical gesture that you and I do on a daily basis, just in our real lives, that's not really theatrical, but that crosses over? Then we cross back into the things that we can see from film when we were still engaged in gesture, then back to silent film, then back before that, we start looking at paintings, then we start reading things that actors are talking about when they talk about gesture. We start looking at actor manuals, how to act. That explained theatrical gesture. And we hit all the way back into John Bulwer's plates on gesture, where we have the first codified, this gesture means this gesture means this. And he's got it written out basically for one set for people who were who had issues with hearing. So it's like the basis of BSL, and for actors, another set of plate for actors. And we started just going through these plates and trying to figure out, okay, well, how would this really look? And the thing that was most helpful to me, really, beyond Bulwer's plates, was finding specific essays from actors, the great actors of the day, on their own personal processes. So the earliest one that I've studied is Betterton, and Thomas Betterton was trained by a man who was trained by Burbage. So when but when I get a little bit closer to today, and we start gently working our way backward. So I look at Edwin Booth, and he talks about his process. And before that, we look at Garrick, and he talks about his process. Before that is Betterton. So we can almost sort of like monkey bars, kind of gently work our way back in time, starting with what we absolutely know and going back and looking at taste, and also looking at art that surrounds it. So for example, not just looking at what actors are saying they're doing, but what other things are out there? What is our current philosophy like at the time? What are we wearing? How's that going to affect gesture? What kinds of philosophy are we reading? What poems are we reading? What's happening to us as a culture? And so we can start to really build a pretty full picture paintings, songs, essays, critics' reviews. And what are we not only striving for, but what are we rejecting as a culture? And we start to build what I think is probably a pretty good picture of what this kind of gesture would have looked like. And then when you incorporate that and put it into your process, when you're trying to recreate the playing practices from any one period, you basically make yourself a little time machine. You know, the one thing that doesn't really change is actors' brains. You know, I'm an actor, you're an actor. We're actors, whereas other people would hate that. I personally would hate being an accountant. My brain doesn't work like that. Our actors' brains are basically the same. And the other thing that people often say is, well, you can't ever recreate an audience. Well, sure you can. The audience is still exactly the same, because that's the other bit. Audience brains are still the same. And if you give audiences certain cues into what, you know, is this, we're going to church, right? You and I decide we're going to go to church together. We can tell what type of church this is based on certain clues that we're being given by the presentation in front of us. Is this the kind of church where I'm going to get up and sing a song and clap? Or is this the kind of church where I'm going to have to be real quiet? And you follow those cues and you're basically the same thing. So we're not, you know, we haven't changed into a different species. We're still just people. And I think ultimately what this is going to tell us is, you know, what does our art say about who we are? How do we present that art? What does that mean for our future? How do we take what we shouldn't have left behind and learn from it? And how do we connect to our past selves so that we can learn something and so that hopefully we can get better? And, you know, there's 1,000 adages about this, right? It's important to connect to our past selves and to think about this so that we can get better. So that's why I do it.
Mm. I mean, that's all really, really interesting. And this, I mean, thinking to some of the work we're doing sort of slightly more under the radar at the moment is we're looking at jest books.
Oh, cool.
So we're looking at the moment at Richard Tarlton, who is somewhere between a stand-up comic and an actor. And there's stories about some of his escapades and some of his reactions with audiences. Mm. And you're getting a real gauge of what those audiences are like and the kind of games they're playing with him and the kind of improvisation he's doing with them. I mean, he's a total bastard. his comedy is not nice. It's the kind of thing you'd expect from the 1970s, some of it. But the audience makes as much fun of him as he gives back in terms of put-downs, to the point where, in theory, I mean, some of these stories are probably not true. But there is a story of effectively the audience singing I don't know if this happens in the US, but in the UK, you know, football chants where the crowd is has basically taken a standard tune and just written their own lyrics about how useless a player is. And there is an instant. One of the stories is basically he got his clothes nicked and had to go out in his nightshirt one day. And they're all going, "You didn't have your clothes." And that's coming out of the audience. quite apart from the fact that this story also features the idea that he had two musicians on tap who woke him up in the morning. We don't know how that works at all, and that's something I need to do a lot more research on. But there's basically two fiddle players called Fancy and Nancy would come round in the morning with their renowned boys and would play him awake, and he'd toss them some coins. And that's the distraction that led to having his clothes nicked. Now, some of that might not be true, but it's a great story.
Oh, it's a great story. Yes. You know, you remind me, I've got to read Tarlton's Jests. I've never read it. And that's fantastic. I would love to learn more about that. I hope that I'll find a way to see your work as that progresses. And no, we don't have, I mean, I don't see that many sporting events. We just do generally disorganized shouting. but oh God, I love the English. You guys as a group are really good at putting people down. Really organized tomfoolery. It's well done. Mm.
Well, as I said, at the moment we're just working through the stories, but we are looking to do a show where we try and figure out what's the truth and what's not and his different comic personas. So hopefully, you know, there'll be something coming out next year, which will be available on the internet because everything we do goes, everything gets recorded. Everything gets recorded.
Wow.
And then eventually it gets released when a slot appears. Because we already release two podcasts a week, and we
we
of varying degrees of finishedness.
Right.
So we do read throughs as well as proper full cast audios, and you just keep finding things and keep going. Oh, that's another one to go on the list. That's another show we're going to do next year. We haven't got any more shows.
Wow.
It's just so much. And then you get things like Talking Horses, and it's just, the things just get weird really quickly when you start diving in the Apocrypha. All sorts of strange stuff. Anyway, we should talk about plays. You must be knackered, by the way. You've having just Arden of Faversham has just opened, or is opening, or you've got through tech, or where are you?
We just opened. We had a preview on Friday. We opened Saturday and had a show on Sunday. Now got a little bit of a break before we circle back and have more shows on Thursday. I love this show. For every bit of physically tired I am emotionally just really energized, because there's nothing I like more than to laugh. And I've just been in stitches over this show. It makes me laugh so hard. It reminds me of an early modern Coen Brothers film. It's very Fargo.
So for the listeners at home, it's the cheerful, happy story of an attempted murder that takes a very, very, very long time to reach some form of fruition.
Yeah, well, who doesn't think that bumbling criminals are funny?
You know,
I personally, I can't handle a film that is too thrilling, unless any kind of horror or true crime usually really bothers me. But man, I loves me a dumb criminal. And that's basically what this is. It's just some really stupid murder plans. And they get so frustrated that, at their continued failure at trying to murder Arden, that plans become increasingly desperate and increasingly poorly planned out. And so then, it does, of course, spoiler alert, take a turn when they finally do get him.
We'll get upset emails now. Spoilers.
Well, unfortunately, it's a true crime story. So
yes,
it's already out there. It's 1550s. The crime happened. We're actually sneaking up on the anniversary. The anniversary of Arden's actual murder is this Valentine's Day. It's February 14.
I noticed you had a Valentine's Day special, which I thought was beautifully judged.
That's right. Passion makes people do all sorts of things, doesn't it? So we'll have sort of a dark Valentine's Day special. I think it's 463 years since the murder. And that it had to have really rocked England, because the play itself wasn't written until 1592. So just one of those things that stuck with people. It was written about in Holinshed Chronicles, and stuck with people long enough to not only write a play about it, but write a funny play about it. That means it's good.
And it is interesting, actually, quite a lot of plays feature quite badly organized murders. Even if they're played more seriously than this, it does seem that they did know about the technicality of how difficult it sometimes could be to kill someone. Because there was just so many more opportunities then, and so many more of the actors had first-hand experience of occasionally murdering people.
Oh my gosh! Oh, there's a line in it. One of these bumbling ruffians basically says, "If only I could turn murder into an occupation without fear of the law." He just loves it. Murder's so much fun for him. So this play just really it really tickles me. It's good stuff.
And to be fair, spoilers again, the they do get their just desserts at the end. They don't get away with it, people. So, there is a moral. There's a moral.
Yeah, like any good comedy, there's a moral. And that's kind of the wonderful thing about it, is that they're not only caught, they're caught within minutes. They struggle to kill this man for a month. and then upon fruition are literally caught within minutes. You just got to plan your murders out better. That's the moral of this story. No, that's not the moral. Murdering people's bad.
Yeah. Well, there is that running sense of, will they manage it this time? Will they manage it this time? Will no. Will he, Arden, ever die?
Not even. And you know, it's got that great whodunit feel, or that sort of, you know, campy Clue feeling to it, because so many people in the town hate this man.
Yes.
The author and or authors have set it up just, he is the most hated man in town, and he's completely oblivious to this. He's very 1%-y, in my opinion. He just doesn't really get it. You know, Reed the sailor comes up to him and asks him for a small favor. You know, you've gotten all this land. I'm about to go out back on duty, back to the sea. Can you please just leave the land, the little tiny patch of land that I have, for my wife and children, so that they don't go hungry and, you know, without clothing, so they don't die impoverished in the street? And Arden's just like, what? No, that's my land. Like, he doesn't even understand. And then he sort of has a line, you know, can you believe this guy? He says, this is the railingest knave in Christendom. Can you believe this? He's just completely clueless to it. Yeah. So, of course, a lot of people want to kill Arden.
Yeah, it does have that connection with modern murder mysteries or whodunits, where you set up the victim who, and everybody hates them because you want to get the idea that any of them could have done it. Obviously, we know who's doing it, but it does have that sort of connection in genre terms. I don't know if that's right. Is it more like a Columbo than anything else?
Well, you know, I stand by it. It is almost exactly like Fargo in terms of even, you know, the body being drug out in the snow at the end. Mm. Has those sort of broadly drawn characters. I don't think Columbo's too far away from it. Just sort of Columbo in reverse in terms of, you know, the whole time you're right there, you've seen it happen, and you get to, you don't want Columbo to come and figure it all out. But of course he does immediately. Mm. And to be fair, our mayor who comes in and solves things at the end, we have sort of modeled him after a Columbo to a certain extent.
So that is going well, and you have, I expect by the time this goes out, it will all be over, but do you see it possibly coming back again in the future?
Oh, what a nice question. You know, I think it might. And just because it is so fun, and for us, it's one of the plays that we've done that actually has the fewest actors involved. Mm. Normally we're looking at, you know, a cast crew of 16 to 20. Mm. And this one really only has, including musicians, 12. So I know whereas that's a big cast for other people, for us, it's pretty small. And so I think it does lend itself to touring a little bit better than others. And we haven't done the Edinburgh Fringe Festival since about 9 years ago, when we went with a show called You Wouldn't Know Her, She Lives in London. And on that side of the world, it was called You Wouldn't Know Him, He Lives in Texas. Mm. And it was a Skype interactive play that we did in two locations at once, and then had a third online audience for so that everybody could kind of be interactive. So it's been long enough that I'd really like to go back. We might be looking for some various festivals and stuff to go to, especially because the play is, I think, you know, significant culturally, and not many people get to see it. Mm. So we might take it around a little bit. It could be fun.
Well, I mean, it's that thing that you're right. It isn't actually too massive a cast, is it? You know, and even without adaptation or moving things around, it is because it is that quite domestic sphere. For you know, it's not like you have too many supernumeraries or extended you know, journeyings, except to different potential murder sites.
That is accurate. And plus, with us, because of the way we work, we don't need lights. Mm. We don't need any of that stuff. We don't really need special sound effects. We take care of all those things on our own. Mm.
Well, if you do, let me know, and because I'd love to see it. I mean, if you are, do you archive anything in terms of for future reference or the world? Is that a possibility? I'm all on the archiving things and making it available for others, for the next people who come along.
Yes, we do, as a matter of fact. And our last several shows are available online on our website. We've got, I need to unpassword some of them. I think some of them have been passworded, unfortunately. But our last few shows, The Rover by Afra Ben, is archived. Yeah, we've got a bunch of our stuff. I need to make sure that that's more available to people because, it ain't going anywhere. Yeah, we've got it all. Mm. I think only one or two that we, for various reasons, didn't manage to get recorded. But almost all of our shows are.
Because that's the lovely potential that we have now is that, the problem is always trying to sell these shows and trying to sell them to not just to new audiences, but to new artists and the next people who come along. When the best you've got is here is a printed text that is not very well edited, that has been sitting on a shelf for hundreds of years, or is just not really available, and that's your starting point. That it's sort of just constantly setting plays up to fail or not to happen, and trying to find easy routes in for people is sort of my bag, as it were.
Oh. I might then add, our very last show actually was Duchess of Malfi.
Yes, we were about to move on to, so.
And that'll be, it's just being edited down now, and we will have that one available online. Yeah, and then we're taking it to Shakespeare's Globe. We're taking it to the Wanamaker in June. We're also taking it to the Shakespeare Institute in Stratford-upon-Avon, and also the King Edward Grammar School in Stratford-upon-Avon. So we'll be performing there.
Yes, well, actually, I was going to say about Matthew. So you're coming to the UK for my UK listeners. We're international, so I won't be biased. So you're coming over in June, and so that's a revival. So are you starting back from first principles? Are you returning with the same sort of company you started? How did Malfi come for you the first time around, as it were?
Sure. Dr. Farah Karim had just finished editing her version of Duchess of Malfi for Arden. She was really in love with it. And we wanted a project by which we could start working on something that I don't think anybody had tackled quite yet, which was theatrical gesture in the Renaissance/Jacobean era. And so we decided to go with Duchess because the timing just seemed right. So we began that project, did it here in Austin to surprisingly, just people really enjoyed it. You know, that play is so unusual, and Webster really pulls out all the stops in it. You know, there's a werewolf in it, for crying out loud. It reminds me of sort of like an early modern haunted house, like a 1960s style haunted house movie. Very psychedelic and strange. He really makes some very odd and interesting choices in it. So yes, we will be taking it over to the Globe with our full team. So it's just a remount.
So, but pretty much the same cast and mm-hmm. same principles that you started with. Excellent.
Exactly.
I mean, the Duchess of Malfi. You're right. I mean, it's there's some very, very visceral stuff. I mean, it is that sort of weird horror film vibe when we get towards the... Spoiler alert again. Duchess of Malfi doesn't go well for the Duchess of Malfi, listeners. Or for that matter, some other people, quite a few people die horribly.
Yep.
But you have this chamber of horrors with waxworks where her brothers, who object to the whole idea of her having any autonomy whatsoever, are just tormenting her with people from an asylum and waxwork effigies of her dead children, and that's all just the preamble for the actual her actual eventual murder. I mean, he goes for it.
really goes for it. Yeah, like if you think about it, he's got a severed hand. He's got the waxworks. He's got the madhouse imagery. He's got so much murder. And the one thing I noticed that I thought was maybe missing was a magic trick, and I was confused as to why he didn't use a magic trick. And I think I've recently found that he probably did, and I'm trying to work with some scholars right now who specialize in early modern magic to see if we can recreate what I believe is meant to be a magic trick in here as well.
Oh, excellent. I like a bit of magic. there is a sort of warnings via echoes and things.
I think it's in the echo scene.
Yes, repeating cogent lines about what terrible things are going to happen towards the end of the play for the unfortunate husband. So it's been a little while since I watched it.
Yes, that's right. Her husband is unaware that she has already been murdered by this point. He's walking through a cavernous area, trying to make amends with her brothers and hopefully get things back sorted. And an echo, it keeps repeating certain lines to try and warn him away. And then he says on the last echo, I marked none of those except the last one, which I saw a light and then a face folded in sorrow. And I'm just thinking that light was probably some type of firework, some type of flash paper, which we know they had, and trying to determine whether or not that face folded in sorrow was just the Duchess popping in for a second, but if it was her whole body, then they wouldn't have just said her face. We're just trying to figure out exactly what this magic trick might have been if I'm completely wrong and there was no magic trick and I've done all this research for nothing, but I think there was, because otherwise Delia wouldn't say that's just your fancy. I didn't see that. There wouldn't have been a need for him to have said that if the audience wasn't then wondering, did I see something real or did I see something that is all in all of our collective imagination? So that's what I'm. So it kind of goes back to what we do, right? It's sort of this theatrical archaeology, you know, taking these little clues and making big choices to try and get the time machine humming up and see if we can figure out how we used to tell our stories.
Well, I, one of the things I always find, I'm always surprised with any text, even if it's a reasonably well-known play like Duchess of Malfi, is that when you actually start doing bits of it yourself or much less well-known plays, it's just how immediately you go, oh, I've got all this wrong. I've misunderstood this scene. You know, you read it off a page and I always get it wrong. And how much suddenly you have so many options and possibilities that come out of a scene, even scenes that don't look on the page like there's anything really to it. And the moment you get it on its feet, it's just... Yeah, there's so many things you could do. And with a play as busy potentially as this, it's also that difference in how you deal with the space in terms of lighting as well. The difference between a shared light experience and more modern conventions is, where does the funny come from? Well, when it's a more shared experience, there are more laughs. And it's a fundamentally different kind of show than right. When you plunge everybody into darkness and even the funniest comedies die. I think you've touched on Arden in the past when you were looking at other, you have them down as apocrypha, so looking at Musidorus and Merry Devil of Edmonton. Were they rehearsed readings or stage readings that you did in the past? Just thinking about process for Arden of coming from a point in the past when it's a reading rather than a full production. Is there a process there?
Well, it's the first time we've ever tried that. And what we did is I was really interested in the Apocrypha. And so I, with the very kind permission of Eric Rasmussen, from, who published with Jonathan Bate these, you know, these collaborative works, chose those three plays and gave them stage readings and just to see, you know, how are they? How do they work? Three rehearsals for each one, did a weekend of shows fully costumed up on their feet. We don't ever do staged readings, just, you know, sitting. We stage them. That's, you know, a misnomer, right? So, you know, characters and usually live musicians, and we really get in there and we play it as best we can. And really just the only difference is that people have scripts in hands and haven't really had the chance to, you know, do deep dives into the work. We found that Arden of Faversham was far and away the superior play, and I'd always wanted to go back and do it again. And so now I had a little space in the calendar, so we popped it back up. And just really tried to dig in a little bit deeper. I changed the notion of it. I actually did something we don't normally do, which is I went ahead and gave it a different setting. I gave it sort of at least the hint of a 1961 setting, just sort of the tail end of that Leave It to Beaver era of a nuclear family, or at least the appearance of a nuclear family on the outside, with you know, all of the nastiness sort of bubbling underneath.
Is it? Did you find there's a difference between that earlier version and coming through to this production now, or was it a matter of sort of refining things that you'd found the first time around?
Honestly, you know, because my crew works so very well together, and they know each other so well, I have found that tonally it's basically about the same. And that really the main difference is just for the few actors that we have that are different from the stage reading, just because of schedules and whatnot, they're different takes on things and, you know, the luxury of time. But basically, yeah, it's the same show. And it actually got one of my favorite audience reactions from the stage reading, which is somebody actually said they peed their pants. They laughed so hard. And I wondered why that particular audience member had sort of popped out of their seat and was scooched way forward because she was really close to me. And it's because she peed her pants. She laughed that hard.
Did you put that in the publicity at all?
I did. Yeah, I did. Of course I did. She peed.
Yeah.
It really is that funny, I think, this way. But isn't it exciting? I mean, it's so frustrating to me when there's so much exciting work that's available, and then yet, you know, so many companies just don't take advantage of that, and then you kind of are forced to do the same bits pumped out over and over and over again. And it's like, well, I could go see your Macbeth again, or just for kicks, you know, there's an entire world of material that's out there to be, you know, to be plumbed. So.
We call it the Midsummer Night's Dream event horizon, which is when you have a very serious, either new writing or classics company, and they spend 5-10 years working really hard to do, you know, exciting stuff that's never been seen before, and then eventually they just go, let's just do Midsummer Night's Dream. And from that point on, their company identity dissolves, and they just sink into the ether. It's just a black hole that just it's just no. All the chips are down now. You know, all the bets are off.
Yeah, I get that. Well, for me, whenever we actually do just a straight play anymore that hasn't, you know, that isn't a variant in some way, it always just feels so much easier, because otherwise we're putting in a year, 2 years of research. On playing practices to make that thing work, right?
Well, thank you very much for coming on the podcast. I'm hope everything goes well with the rest of Arden and with the upcoming Malfi.
Thank you so much for having me. What a thrill. I had the greatest time talking with you about anything that is not a certain playwright, but other things. It was really fun. Oh, and if anybody is interested, they can learn more about us at www.hiddenroomtheatre.com. And, you know, come say hello if you see us in England. We'd be thrilled to say hi.
And all details will be found on the show notes with this podcast.
Many thanks to Beth Burns for sharing their time and discussing Arden and other plays. Sadly, as mentioned earlier, this is all material in the past tense. I don't know whether there will be more to come. But links to the materials and website is mentioned in the show description, so you can find out some more information there. You've been listening to the Beyond podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Beyond Shakes, support us on Patreon at patreon.com/Beyond Shakespeare, or buy us a coffee on ko-fi.com/Beyond Shakespeare, and all that jazz. Till next time, I've been your host, Robert Crichton. Goodbye.